My guest today, Lizzie Carr, is on a mission to clean up the world's rivers and waterways. Her organisation, Planet Patrol, is working to eliminate single-use materials and litter, like plastic, to protect our planet and wildlife for the future. Planet Patrol is no ordinary environmental organisation, and Lizzie is no ordinary activist. She's made history. In 2016, she became the first person to travel the entire length of Britain's waterways on a paddleboard. The year after that, she went one step further, becoming the first woman to paddleboard solo across the English Channel. Then in 2018, Lizzie took on her biggest challenge yet, paddleboarding the entire length of the Hudson River in America.
It was quite foggy, and just seeing this huge cargo ship coming towards me out of the distance whilst I was in the shipping lane. And I just remember the captain on the support boat just saying to me very calmly, but very firmly, "Lizzie, you need to paddle now very hard for 10 minutes. It was about 3 miles away from me and it looked humongous.
But these challenges were about more than making it into the record books. Lizzie did it all to inspire people to start talking about the plastic polluting our waters. I'm Ian Wright from Something Else. This is Everyday People. We're going to start in the mid-2010s. Lizzie had recently graduated with an English degree and secured a top job in marketing. She was working in the city, earning decent money, but something was missing.
Do you know, I was happy, but I wasn't fulfilled.
Right.
I think at the time I thought I was happy. I thought I was achieving what I wanted to achieve, because you're conditioned to believe, aren't you, that a good paycheck and a good job title and you're on that road to success.
Oh my God.
In those 3 years, I was just stuck in the rut
limbo.
Everyone gets stuck in. Yeah,
limbo.
Just I can't leave my job. I can't take time out. I need to keep working hard. I need to keep sort of pushing myself and grinding, because that's what you're meant to do. And then I think eventually it kind of got a bit too much. It's like, if I don't do it now, I'm in my mid-20s, I'm never going to do this. I never took a gap year. I hadn't really traveled. I didn't have much money growing up. So it wasn't like I'd had all these great experiences, but I managed to save a little bit. And I thought, it's now or never, I suppose.
Right. And so you took some time out to travel. And where'd you go?
I went through sub-Saharan Africa. And
wow.
I did the Trans-Siberian Railway through Mongolia and Russia. I went to China and I hiked through some of the like provinces in Western China. I tried to travel to quite remote places and really embed myself as much as I could in the cultures and the people that I met when I was traveling.
So you wait 7 months and you come back. Tell me about when you get back.
Gosh, I mean, that's when the real whirlwind starts. So I got back and I hadn't started my job straight away. I still had a few weeks and I had a lump in my throat.
How long? How long did you have that?
Well, I'd had it the whole time I was travelling and I'd always been aware of it, but I just didn't really think anything of it. So I'd probably had it about a year and a half before.
Wow.
And because I hadn't started back at work and I had a bit of time on my hand, I just made a doctor's appointment to go and get it checked.
And what were you told? What's that like?
So at first I wasn't told. I was actually dismissed quite a lot because I was 25 when I first started, having the tests and going to the doctors, and I was misdiagnosed quite a lot.
Jesus.
And just kept being told, no, you're young, fit and healthy. There's nothing wrong with you. Basically stop wasting our time.
Oh my God.
And I was quite persistent, really.
Why was you so persistent? Was it starting to hurt or was it hurting you, or was you feeling it all the time? Was you touching it?
Yeah, I was touching it all the time. And it probably sounds quite strange. And I don't really know how to explain it, but I remember I used to like wake up in the middle of the night and I used to say to my boyfriend, I don't think I'm going to like live to my 30th birthday.
Oh my God.
I don't know why. I just had a sense. I just knew something was wrong and I couldn't put my finger on it. And I didn't know if it was this lump in my throat or not, but something was telling me that there was a problem and I was feeling this like deep sense of anxiety. So I ended up seeing a different doctor and getting a second opinion who set me off on a very different course. And obviously that then led to my cancer diagnosis and the treatment that I went on to have. But I just always look back and think, my goodness, if I'd have listened to that first doctor that said to me, just leave it, if it gets any worse, come back in a couple of years, I wouldn't be here now.
Lizzie was eventually diagnosed with stage 2 thyroid cancer. This would be difficult news for anyone to take, but for an otherwise fit and healthy 26-year-old, it was a huge shock. She began treatment.
So what I had is called radioactive iodine ablation. So you just take a radioactive pill and you're sort of locked in this lead-lined room in the hospital for about a week. And all your food is served to you through like
a prisoner
in the door.
Like a prisoner.
Basically, yeah. It's like being in lockdown.
was you allowed to leave that room?
No, because really radioactive. I was like, no one was allowed in or out.
Oh God, how's that? How did you find that?
Really, really tough, because at that time you're still processing what's just happened to you and all of these emotions that you're feeling, and just being forced to be in complete isolation, you know, by yourself dealing with all of that stuff, it's really tricky. And you know, in back then in the hospital, this is I think 8 years ago now, there was no Instagram, there was no Netflix, there was none of this stuff, there was no real distractions. It was just you left with your own thoughts.
God, and what were those thoughts? What was you thinking?
Sort of look back on my life and my job and the pace that I was living and working, and just thought, what am I doing? That was the moment it really struck. I think I'd already got a sense of it when I'd gone traveling, and I think coming back to that just cemented it all for me.
Are you religious? Did you have any kind of religious feelings, like this is all a sign, going there, seeing a simple life, coming back, getting that illness, having to like recalculate everything, what's going on in your life? Was there any kind of religious vibe about you?
Do you know, I'm not really religious, but in that time I was God-fearing. It was like I called to God, I prayed.
Yeah. And that's what I'm thinking. You in that room, you know, being like the food served in like a prisoner, you must be talking to someone in your in there.
Yeah, it was. It was like, if you let me get through this, I promise that I will spend more time with my friends and family. I promise that I will live a life that is so meaningful and I'll give so much back. Just let me live, basically.
When you left hospital, what happened from there?
So I went to go and stay with my dad. He lives on the Isles of Scilly, a little island at the end of Cornwall. Mm. I was quite weak, I would say, and just... there was a lot of brain fog, and I think that was probably half processing the cancer and half just being in like this strange feeling in my body, just adjusting to this total transformation I think I'd gone through. We went and sat on the beach most afternoons, and I would just, you know, look out onto the water. And one day I saw somebody paddleboarding, and I said to my dad, I really, really want to give that a go. Like, I really feel that I could do it. I think it would be really good for me.
Right.
So I walked over to the sailing club on the beach, and I asked to borrow one of their paddle boards. And they sort of said, have you done it before? I was like, no, but I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
You're sort of thinking, how hard can it be? And honestly, as soon as I was on the water and as soon as my paddle hit that water, I was like, this is for me. This is what's missing.
Gosh.
This is what I need.
Just for the people who don't know, can you just explain the paddle board, how long it is, what you're doing on it?
So it's basically an oversized surfboard with a paddle, and you just stand, you can kneel on it, but you stand on it and just propel yourself along using your paddle.
Okay. That simple.
And so have you done it?
I tried it, but like, I'm not very good in big water, Liz. I don't surf. I don't do none of that stuff, but like, I've seen it and it does look good, because all the other people I'm with, my missus does it, everybody else does it. I can't get out over the mental block of it. How far did you go?
I think that's fair.
Do you think so?
I don't like not seeing what's underneath
me.
Yeah, I mean, I went on it really because I wanted to start building my physical strength back up.
Right.
But what I got from it that I didn't expect was this mental side of it, being out on the water and paddling along, just hearing like the song of the paddle, you know, the water as you're as you're paddling along, the sound of it coming out, and just feeling this total sense of freedom and calm. There was this really awful situation in my life that I was kind of dealing with and trying to work through, and when I was out on the water, I just didn't really think about it.
Lizzie found something that she loved, but soon it was time for her to return to her old life in London. At weekends, she kept up the paddleboarding on canals, but when she went back to work, something didn't feel right.
I literally one day, it was a Wednesday morning, and I got on the train and I just looked around all these grey faces on the train doing their commute. And I just thought, I can't do this anymore. It's just something just clicked. And I thought, you know, I've had cancer. That's the worst thing I think I'll ever experience in my life. And if I can get through that and move forward from it, then I can get through anything. I don't really care what happens now. If it, you know, what can really go wrong? I've got my health, I've got my family, I've got my friends. Nothing else really matters that much to me now. So I just went in that morning. I said to my boss, I can't do this anymore. I'm gonna leave. And I rang my boyfriend and I said, I've just quit my job.
Was there any moments where you're thinking, oh my gosh, I actually don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. What was those moments like? So you think, oh God, what have I done? Did you have those moments? What have I done?
No. Do you know what? To this day, it's nearly 5 years, I think, since I've quit. And I've never in a single moment looked back and thought, what have I done? I shouldn't have done that.
So you're still doing your paddling.
Mm-hmm.
What happens then? What happens?
So I'm still paddling and still going through the canals in London. And I think at that point, getting more and more frustrated about the amount of litter that I'm seeing absolutely everywhere.
Can I just set the scene for people listening? So you're doing your stuff, you're just doing your serene stuff, you're just going along and you're feeling, this is beautiful, this is where I get my vitamins, doing my paddleboarding, and you're seeing plastic everywhere.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it was everywhere. And I would get plastic bags caught in my paddle when I was going along the water, or bottles would roll from one end of the board and pop out the other end.
Oh my gosh.
And then I'd see just swans chewing at sweet wrappers and crisp wrappers, and these nests just made up almost entirely of plastic, like straws and wrappers and bags and that kind of thing. And you'd see little eggs in them and you'd think, as soon as these eggs hatch, the first thing they're going to see is plastic.
Yes.
And it just really hit me. And being out in the water more, it wasn't a positive experience anymore. It was really sitting heavy with me. I suppose from there, it was like, how can I make people see this problem and understand this problem the way that I see it and understand it? Mm-hmm. And that's when my first kind of big idea to paddleboard the length of England came from. I paddleboarded the length of England from the most southerly to the most northerly point. I hadn't been paddleboarding that much, and I remember thinking, it can't be that hard, I can just train on the go. So I'd done a bit of training like leading up to it, but for me it was more mind over matter. I've just, you know, got to get through this. So I would normally wake at around 6 a.m. because I was in some farmer's field and had to get out of the field before anyone woke up. So I'd get up sort of just before daybreak.
So you had a tent?
I had a tent, yeah. Put the tent on the front of my boards. Had a little stove, and I drank the canal water as well. I used that to cook too. So I filtered it.
Explain.
In this little...
Explain.
I filtered it.
Oh, God. So you had to find out about the filtering, and it was okay to drink and everything, especially with your condition. Weren't you worried about that?
Well, yeah, I got quite sick for the first few days.
Gosh, Liz.
But after that, it was completely fine. Mm-hmm. I'd paddle for about 10 hours a day, every day. And then just before sort of dusk, as the sun would set, I would sort of find somewhere to pitch up my tent again and camp, get a bit of food, and just sleep. It was literally like eat, sleep, paddle, repeat.
Did you have any problems with pitching up your tent anywhere? Did anybody say to you, get off my land, any kind of stuff like that? Or was you okay?
Do you know what? It was all absolutely fine. And I remember waking up one morning in a farmer's field and I saw his tractor in the distance and I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble here. And he came down and he just waved at me. And I just thought, you hero, that's amazing. But I suppose for me, it was important, like the idea of leave no trace. I would arrive late, leave early. I wouldn't leave any sign that I'd been there, and I'd carry on my journey. Like I wasn't doing any harm with that.
So tell me about what you were seeing.
So around the water, I mean, it was just laden with plastic, a soup of plastic along the waterways. And I was photographing everything that I saw. I couldn't pick it up because if I did, my board would probably sink.
Right.
I was photographing and logging every single piece of plastic along that journey. So what I encountered as one individual as I paddleboarded through the length of England. And I mean, there was so much I missed. I could only get like one side of a riverbank, for example.
Of course.
And I can't capture what's underneath the water. So I just got a snapshot of how big this problem is, basically. And it was just, there were the most random things. Like you'd find plant pots, car bonnets, umbrellas, so many bikes in there. Just, you name it, I've probably found it on a canal or river in this country.
So what do you think? So you've got this sense of sadness, but you know what's going on, and you feel like you obviously feel like you want to do something, taking the photos and everything to document it. So what do you do?
So I built a map of all the photos that I'd taken, and I analysed them all and picked the four worst affected areas around the country. I went back to those areas and I litter picked, and I collected thousands of bottles, and then I made a raft out of those bottles.
Right.
And I floated it down the River Trent in Nottingham. And then on the other side of that, I then... I suppose I was really fortunate because I was using paddleboarding as a vehicle to talk about the environment. Because if I'd have talked to people about plastic, then no one would have really listened. And I knew that because I tried and it hadn't really worked.
Right.
So by paddleboarding and setting this kind of world first expedition, I could get people to really think about it a bit more. When I finished and people were asking how they could get involved, the other thing that I did was invite people out on the water with me. So I sort of put it on social media at that point. You know, if anyone wants to come paddleboarding, all completely free, I'm going to be at various places around the country. I'll teach you, and your payment, your nature tax, is to litter pick and log everything that you find with me. And people came, people got involved. I mean, I was amazed that people actually wanted to
like
do
when
it.
When you went yourself and you're getting yourself ready and then you saw the first person turning up? What was that feeling like?
I remember thinking, I can't believe someone's come out to litter pick. Because nobody was really litter picking then. Lots of people litter pick now. But back then, I mean, we would get heckled all the time for looking like we were on community service, or people would just shout abuse at us all the time, litter picking. But now it's completely transformed and people like applaud you and thank you.
How much litter do you think that you have found since you started doing this?
We've tracked it as much as we can. I would say about 500 tons we've collected over the last few years.
No way. No way. How did you persuade people to come and actually pick rubbish out of the canal?
I think a lot of people were tempted by the idea of paddleboarding for free. I think a lot of people were there for the
adventure. Where'd you get all the paddleboards from?
I was lent them. This is a hilarious thing. Like, I didn't even own a paddleboard when I did that first challenge. I borrowed it from the local club. So it was just, I couldn't afford to buy one. It was just this really heavy paddleboard and this old crappy paddle. Mm. And then when I'd finished it, I contacted a few brands and said, look, I just need three or four boards. Just want to take a handful of people out with me to paddleboard. And I was given a few boards, which meant I could go out. And I borrowed my boyfriend's van, which I ended up crashing, but we won't talk about that part. So it's much more organised now and it's grown a lot and it's like a legitimate organisation. But when I started, it was just me. I didn't know what I was doing. There was no blueprint for what I was creating. I didn't even know I was creating it.
Lizzie was in the process of creating Plastic Patrol, an environmental organisation which is now known as Planet Patrol. One of the people who joined Lizzie on those early cleanups was Tom Rook.
What's wonderful about Lizzie is she's completely humanised the whole journey of being more environmentally conscious and ethical and all trying to do our bit. She's made it very uncomplicated. She's made it fun. People are signing up. A lot of the Planet Patrol litter picks that we do sell out in days, sometimes hours. So everybody's keen to get involved, and she started that. And that form of inspiration, you know, if you could bottle that, wow, just as long as the bottle's not plastic.
He's right. How's that make you feel, Liz?
Oh, that's a brilliant message. Emotional.
I've got to ask you about something, Liz, because it was an amazing thing even just to think about. In 20, 17, you paddled the English Channel. Now, I just, because remember I mentioned earlier on, like, I'm scared of that kind of big water. What was that like? And why the English Channel?
I used to be really scared of water. Open water. Like, I really do empathise with the feelings of being out in the ocean. And, paddling the English Channel, I mean, that was pretty surreal, actually. But the whole point of that was around highlighting microplastic pollution. I'd kind of gone from the big plastics in canals and rivers to where it ends up. Once it degrades and breaks down, it turns into microplastics. And they are just, you know, filled in the ocean is filled with them. And
can you explain just what they are? So they break down. And so what do they do?
Yeah. So the microplastics, just really like almost microscopic pieces of plastics. Often they're fibers from our clothing, like synthetic clothing. That's what the biggest microplastic kind of perpetrator is in the sea. So just by washing your clothes, you're adding to it with every load that you wash. And fish eat them. Obviously, then big predator fish eat the smaller fish. And then we eat some of the bigger predator fish, and it ends up back in the human food chain. And what we don't know now is the implications of these microplastics that are being eaten by fish and now ending up in our human bodies, like long term, what that means. Like, we're only just starting to unpick some of the science around that now. So it's actually quite terrifying to think that we're the guinea pigs for this, for the, sort of the plastic generation.
Lizzie thought that if she could make it into the news by paddleboarding across the English Channel, then maybe she could encourage people to have conversations about the environment. But physically, crossing the channel was a bigger challenge than she could ever have imagined.
It was quite foggy, and just seeing this huge cargo ship coming towards me out of the distance whilst I was in the shipping lane. And I just remember the captain on the support boat just saying to me very calmly, but very firmly, "Lizzie, you need to paddle now very hard for 10 minutes. And I'm like,
in a certain direction. In a certain direction.
In the right direction. Don't get this wrong.
Back in a moment.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Hello, it's me, Jamie Lang, and I've got a new podcast, and this time there are no gimmicks. It's just great company. Because the thing is, I realize the reason I love podcasts so much is because they're a great way to connect with people.
Hello, I'm Youngblood.
Joe Brand.
I'm Paloma Faith.
Jay Blades.
Elizabeth Day.
Zara Larson. Casper
Lee. And I'm Great Company.
Great Company.
Great Company.
Great Company.
Apparently.
It's Great Company with me, Jamie Lang. Coming Wednesday, the 27th of March.
So did he tell you why, or did you know why?
Because I could see that. I could see the ship.
How big did it look?
It was about 3 miles away from me, and it looked humongous.
God, that'd be too much for me.
So you can imagine. And the thing is that boat can't slow down. I'm in its way. It can't just suddenly stop for me. So if I don't get out of its line of passage quickly enough, you know, I'm going under.
Just in time, Lizzie made it out of the way of the ship and into the Guinness Book of Records. It was an incredible effort, and most people might have stopped there, but Lizzie wanted a bigger challenge. In 2018, she turned her attention to America and attempted to cross the tidal length of the Hudson River in New York, 170 grueling miles.
When you hear the word river, it conjures up quite images of serene, picturesque environments, and actually that river it's a real beast, and it frightened me, to be honest.
I tell you what, we listened to a clip from your sister Angela about this challenge.
Flying out to America to do something like that, it was just amazing, and it was great to have crazily enough, and the technology we have today that allows you to do this, whilst she's out on a paddleboard in the middle of the Hudson River, that we're able to talk over FaceTime. And the crazy thing was, I remember one time I called her and there was a thunderstorm that was in the distance. And I think being out on the water, you know, you could get hit by lightning, all of those things. And so it was just, you know, keeping her calm, making sure she had someone there, because I'm sure, you know, for her, it was incredibly lonely and scary. And several times we were on the phone talking in those situations just to keep her mind busy and talking about fun things, as siblings do.
Was this one a lot more scary? It sounded like it was a lot more scary, more treacherous.
Oh, gosh, yeah. This brings back memories. Storm Gordon was just leaving the East Coast, and Hurricane Florence was just coming in on the East Coast when I was doing that paddle. So it was throwing up the most absolutely obscene, like, weather conditions. You'd look at the forecast every day and you'd try and identify the windows that you had where it was safe to go out and paddle. And then it would change and you'd be out on the water and you're stuck on the water. Mm. And a lot of the Hudson on one side is a rail track for quite some distance. So you can't get off the water because it's just a solid railway line. Right. There's not anywhere to escape. And there were moments where there were a couple of thunderstorms, one particularly, where I'm on the water and I can see the lightning striking around me. And when you're on the water with a carbon paddle and you're effectively the highest person or the highest thing on that body, you're kind of thinking, I'm sort of treading on thin ice here and I need to get off. I was really, really scared at a few points. And other times, like my sister said, I would call her and just have her in my headphones and be like, just keep me calm, please keep me calm, because I can't spiral. I need to keep focus. I need to keep strong.
Mm. How long did that one take?
Eight days.
Did that trip? And what was it like when you can finally see the Manhattan skyline?
I mean, that was really amazing, actually, seeing that in the distance. Mm. I remember one evening just looking down, straight down the river, and just like quite far in the distance, you could just see the lights of Manhattan. And I was thinking, I'm almost there. I've got this. I can see this now. Mm. And then at the end, obviously, I finished at the Statue of Liberty, and getting sort of standing in front of Lady Liberty in that moment, and everything that she represents and everything that challenge was about was that was an iconic moment for me.
I'm going to say, how do you think the big these expeditions, like these challenges what you've taken, have raised awareness for Planet Patrol?
What I think they've done is created an interesting angle for people to talk about the planet and the environment. Yeah. So again, like with the Hudson, I'd organise community cleanups along the river. We were using the app to track litter that I'd found over there.
Did you get a good response over there, Liz?
Yeah, I did. But I would say that in the US, that they're probably a couple of years behind where the UK is in terms of awareness and action for plastic pollution. I didn't expect it to create a huge impact, but I felt like with the UK, you know, it's been really successful over here and Planet Patrol's really worked. How can I create some friction in one of the world's biggest consumer of single-use plastics and one of the biggest polluters of single-use plastics? So, you know, in somewhere like America, they have the means and the resources to cut that, and they should be doing more with it. I mean, hopefully now they will. But for me, it was just, this problem is so much bigger than what's happening on your doorstep. You know, we're all connected by the same waters. We all have to take action all over the world. So how can I help do that in places where it's possible to do it?
And what next, Liz? What next in respects of raising awareness? Because now I'm looking next to me, I've got a plastic bottle there. What next? What next are you going to do?
To send you a reusable bottle will be my next immediate step.
Thank you very much, Liz. Really sorry.
Do you know what? I think
just feeling guilty about having that plastic. But like the fact is, Liz, just sitting here, because obviously I speak to people and sometimes you go to parties and that people talk about it and it does trigger your conscience. But now I'm sitting here seeing like plastic around, you do feel a little bit more conscious. You do feel
I think
yeah.
It's when you realise the impact that it can potentially have on you. That's when a lot of people are like, actually, I need to do something now. Mm. It's like I read the other day, and obviously I've just had a little baby, that they found microplastics in the umbilical cords of babies. And I just thought, this is ridiculous now. Like, this is so ingrained in our lives. Like, the air we breathe, the salt we eat, the beer we drink, it's plastic in everything now. It's just everywhere. And we really need to get a grip on it because we don't really know what the outcome will be.
I got to say to Liz is that listening to you, it's amazing, the journey. When you look back on the journey, how do you feel in respects of how it kind of started to where you are now?
Do you know, it's just such a whirlwind. It's been 5 years. And I suppose I look back and I think, has that just happened? Is that real? Is this my life? I feel so grateful that I can get up every day and do something that I really care about. And I think looking around at what Planet Patrol has achieved, I mean, we've got hundreds of reps now all over the world. We've collected, like I said earlier, that sort of 500 tons of litter. There's just so much that we've done. We've been to number 10. We've just achieved more than I ever even imagined that it would. And I'm
thankful. You've created a global community off of the fact that, you know, from sitting on, looking out to the sea on the Isles of Scilly, to what you're doing now. Things happen and then unbelievable things come from something that feels like it's a real massive negative. And I can't say how proud I am to be speaking to you, and your family must be very proud of what you've done up to this point.
Thank you. And I think that's really very true. Like, I've always called cancer my biggest nightmare and my greatest blessing. And I think that you've summed that up really well with what you've just said.
If you like what you've heard so far and think you've got an amazing story to tell, I'd love to hear from you. Get in touch at everydaypeople@somethingelse.com. That's everydaypeople@somethingelse.com, without the G. Next time on Everyday People, Running with Purpose, Charlie Duck.
I had a run late one night and I thought to myself, yo, this run is really hard. And I started making these imaginary characters up in my head. Slow Boy, he was one of them, you know. All these different characters, I gave them all names. And as I was running with them, and I started having these conversations with myself and these different characters, I suddenly thought, I should make this real. I should make this a real thing, because it's gonna solve some of the things that are troubling me.
Everyday People is a Something Else production, hosted by me, Ian Wright. This episode was produced by Paul Smith. The series producer is Jade Scott. Our assistant producer is Grace Laker. Our executive producer is Ollie Wilson. Our sound and mix engineer is Josh Gibbs, with thanks to Chris Skinner and Steve Ackerman.